The first session this morning is by Joel Virgo. So I'm going to invite Joel to come up right now. And why don't we give him a warm welcome?
Thank you for your welcome. It's so good to see you. Thank you for coming out on a Saturday to be with us here. I feel a little bit split in that I guess in a sense I'm sort of preaching to the choir, but I also know there are some guests amongst us for whom this will be a very new occasion, lots of new faces. And actually for some of you, I suppose, this may even be the first time you've heard me speak in this room. I don't know, because obviously we've got so many new people coming in amongst our new sites. So I hope you're feeling very welcome wherever you are from, and that I managed to serve all of you all at the same time. Let me just talk a little bit in the time I have about where we're going. This is going to be a sort of very, very rushed affair. In that you know me, or if you know me, you know that I can talk about where we're going for hours, and I don't want to do that. I just want to just quickly rush through some key aspects of vision for us as a church, Christ the King, and how that potentially applies to you guys with your gifting, with your background, with the context in which you operate through the week and through life. We are at a stage of multiplication, which is very exciting indeed. Multiplication is a fun word. It's got lots of positive connotations, and it means that we are growing. It means that we're doing more than we've done before. We're reaching more people than we ever have before. On a Sunday, we have more people than we've ever had before. It's exciting to just look at even statistical things. I'm sure many of you are very statistically oriented people. Just this last week, we're looking at the attendance figures on Sundays, and we're basically 14% more people with us on a Sunday for this first few months of the year compared to the year before, which is a tremendous development. It shows that more and more people are coming to Christ. It means that as we've multiplied into three locations, this time last year we're only meeting in this one, and now we're meeting here and at the racecourse and at Shoreham all at the same time. And it's obviously borne some fruit. There are some encouraging early signs of success and growth. It's only a few months into it. I don't want us to count our chickens or assume anything too presumptuous, but nevertheless, we're encouraged. There are lots of other just encouraging developments. It was a great joy to see 8 different events happening over the Easter weekend with tremendous impact. We gathered nearly 3,000 at these different events, many new people coming to Christ, lots and lots of genuine impact on lives, on marriages, on families. This coming fortnight is exciting, an adventure for us, in as much as the BBC Sunday morning broadcasts to the nation on the TV will be from here, the Pentecost Sunday worship. So we'll be, presumably, we'll be broadcasting to large numbers. We've been told it tends to reach about 1 million. We've also been told that it's just before the Grand Prix broadcast. So I suspect that sort of the last 5 minutes of the show will be when the ratings suddenly go up. So I'm just hoping that the last 5 minutes are the best 5 minutes. But that will be amazing. So it's a really exciting season for that reason too. Obviously, we don't simply live to see numbers on sheets and charts. We are excited because what numbers represent. We genuinely see this as a sign that God is giving us the joy of touching more and more and more and more lives. And we want to do that while we're here. We want to serve God with our whole lives in order to reach more people with the gospel of Jesus than we possibly could imagine. And so we're encouraged about some of these developments. And yet, I want to set all of that in the context of the future. We feel God's called us to more than that. And in this last 7 or 8 months, what more than that can mean has become slightly clearer to us. We believe that God's spoken to us about touching further cities, planting churches into other cities. Back in September, there was a remarkable day where many of the staff were away for a day of prayer and fasting, and a prophetic word was shared, which has really stirred us ever since. We are sensing God's call to pray and get ready to target 5 cities, European cities, with church plants. Those of you that have been around in this church for years will know that, in a sense, this isn't new. We've planted churches over the years. In fact, effectively, CCK has planted almost hundreds of churches over the years in terms of the number of leaders that have been trained here and sent out. And that's been an incredible privilege. But what we feel is a sense in which we want to, in an even more concerted, planned way, target some key cities and aim to plant some robust, healthy churches that can bring blessing, that can shape culture, that can serve people, and bring God's blessing to key city locations. We feel stirred about the scene in Western Europe. There's a sense in which Europe is an unreached part of the world from the point of view of the Christian gospel. It may sound like a strange thing to say, in as much as Europe has historically been associated with Christianity, but we know that the truth is that so much of the world, Christianity is on a tremendous curve of advance. Books like Philip Jenkins' book, The Next Christendom, have sociologically pointed out the massive advance of Christianity in the developing countries, in the global south. In fact, the book that John Micklethwaite, the editor of The Economist, brought out, I guess about 5 years ago now, God is Back, put it like this. He said that basically the whole world understands that God is back. The only places that have refused this are the New York Times, Harvard University, and Western Europe. Those are the only places where God is not apparently back. He wrote the book actually as a kind of a, well, after doing a lot of study on the development of Christianity around the world, not just Christianity, but certainly predominantly Christianity in the developing countries. But he said that they'd done a 2000 Economist edition with the front page being an obituary to God. That was what they wrote it. They actually wrote it as a feature in the Millennium edition of The Economist, that the obituary, God is dead. Well, 5 years later, he's writing this book, God is Back. And I think it demonstrates that perhaps less known in a lot of the kind of opinion-forming circles of the West, but certainly happening, is this advance of Christianity, advance of churches that are thriving around the world. But in Western Europe, this isn't so obvious. You don't see it quite so clearly. It doesn't occupy the public eye in the same way. In fact, Western Europe looks much more post-Christian. Figures of decline are obvious to see. And I think the impact of that on our culture is enormous. What we live in is a context where the Christian message had been such a huge kind of, it's such a central kind of piece of culture in Europe for generations, for centuries, in fact. We live increasingly in a post-Christian age where, to some extent, people have reacted against some of the abuses of the past, and there's a huge running away from certainties, running away from any confidence in any prevailing idea that holds society together. So that when it comes to how opinion is formed, we, I guess, as a result of the sort of the Enlightenment of the 18th century and beyond, what we like to do is divide reality as we see it up into facts that can be understood rationally or empirically, and faith and morality and other things that seem more subjective are put in the bucket of sort of, they're value judgments. We don't really know anything about those, really. That's not true knowledge, that's more opinion. And that's the kind of the modern idea that's prevailed, or is increasingly prevailing, across the Western world, certainly in Western Europe. I think one of the weaknesses, a fundamental weakness of it, is that people are left scratching around for values that are bigger than themselves. Values become self-referential. The values that we live by become, potentially, it can be reduced to just my consumerist preference. These are the values I live by. Those are values you live by. These are values you live by. And it's like everything else in society, values are things that we sort of take off a shelf. These suit me. And what happened in the the philosopher David Bentley Hart talks about the Christian Revolution in the ancient world was the Christian message came in and actually kind of gave the ancient world its soul, a world where so much that went on these days we would think is horrifying, stuff that morally would be, you know, you watch movies like Gladiator and you sense, gosh, what a horrifying world to be part of. But actually the reality is that the ancient world was a world which desperately needed to find a moral compass, to find soul, to find something that set it up within a values framework. And Christianity came at a time which meant that it set the ancient world up, set Europe up on a basis which was to do with, at least largely based on Christian values. Now, in many ways, that was abused. It was done badly. It was done militaristically. It was done in a state-fashioned way. But the impact, in many ways, has been very positive historically, and we still live in the good of it. A very non-Christian philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, recently shocked people by saying Christianity and nothing else is the ultimate foundation of liberty, conscience, human rights, and democracy. This isn't a Christian talking. This is a very secular-minded individual. He said, the benchmarks of Western civilization, to this day, we have no other options than Christianity. We continue to nourish ourselves from this source. Everything else is postmodern chatter. Now, the reason I'm talking about this at a business gathering is because the mission that's before us, as one of the many churches in the UK, and one of the many churches in Brighton, is not simply to serve a few individuals, but to be on mission to bring God's blessing, God's goodness, God's peace to a world that's increasingly sawing off the branch it's sitting on in terms of the values that have kept it healthy for so long. I want to suggest as well that the 21st century mission for us is going to be more business-shaped. The alternative is that we're simply confrontation-shaped. The institutions and cultural frameworks that have gone from being Christian-oriented to being secular. And so the church is reduced to being a source of private comfort to people in need and a kind of moral policeman, just sort of stating what's right and what's wrong, on the edge of society, not really influencing, not really engaging culture, not really bringing genuine transformation, privately engaging but publicly irrelevant. But to engage the emerging world in a fruitful way, a more holistic approach is needed. I think the impact the role of entrepreneurial people, the role of enterprise is significant, is very significant for the tasks that we feel God is giving us. Even historically, you can see how this has happened. You can see how, for example, the 19th century, some of the major names, even brands that we've lived with for generations, names like Guinness, names like Cadbury, firms that were set up by people who had a very committed biblical worldview, but they knew that the way to engage society wasn't only through pulpits, wasn't only through church meetings, but through setting up businesses, setting up industries that actually are based on an ethos that's profoundly Christian. Guinness, actually, although you know you might think, how on earth has that got a Christian ethos? I know Guinness is good for me, but that's not exactly an acceptable advert these days. But Guinness was set up against a backdrop of a culture that was in soaked on gin, where the level of drunkenness, especially in working class society in Ireland, was so high that not only as a way of trying to deal with that, but also as a way of trying to give people a healthy drink that was nutritious and good for them, genuinely, certainly in relation to the alternatives of the time, was right at the centre, the heartbeat of why that well-known brand kind of got moving. It's one example. There are other examples like George Cadbury, who was based in Birmingham. started. These are Christian people who understood that as entrepreneurs, enterprising people who could create businesses that flourished for the public good, they could achieve phenomenal things. And to engage the world, the emerging world, in a fruitful way, we need to adopt more and more of this approach. This doesn't mean that we flee from proclaiming the Christian message and simply become do-gooders. By any means, it means actually we are more consistent with the Christian message. We're more consistent with what we proclaim publicly because we're following it through with social activity, with social enterprise, with business that blesses. And to do that well, I think for us to be sharp about cities, about elites, about institutions is incredibly important. I'm thinking about the ideas of sociologists like James Hunter and Randall Collins. The way in which ideas influence the world and get steam and get moving and bring transformation has so much to do with key cities, key centers of commerce and culture, and actually through elites, and elites sounds like a terrible word, but simply people who have disproportionate influence on culture, and even through institutions. We find ourselves in Brighton, which is an unusual city in so many ways. Some of you have read the books by Richard Florida, who talks about which cities have influence, particularly in the age in which we find ourselves. Brighton, in a recent study, well, I say recent, this is a few years back, but I think it's still relatively relevant to the present time. 8 European nations were studied according to what he called the Bohemian Index. This is the proportion of a given locality's population who are in cultural and artistic occupations. The researchers state that these will play a key role in attracting the other two components of the creative class, creative core and creative professionals. Thus, where this group is proportionally well represented, it is reasonable to expect a snowball effect socially and economically. Population rise, entrepreneurship and growth will tend to follow. On this very index, Brighton Hove comes in as the fourth highest scoring region, the second highest scoring in the UK after London, and the only UK city mentioned beside London. So across Europe, Brighton is a pinnacle city, one of the sort of beacon cities that has disproportionate cultural influence. We have a tremendous opportunity here to touch people who touch culture, to reach people who will have tremendous influence beyond their own immediate location. And as we launch out to touch other cities, we need to say to ourselves, how can we reach these places more and more effectively? It is important to take into account the impact of cities, key, even what we might call elites, which, as I say, sounds like an ugly word potentially, maybe even key institutions. I think churches like ours in our history, understandably, have a bit of a horror even of the word institution. We so want inspiration, which seems the opposite of institution. We want to free people up to run according to the gifting, the grace that's upon them by the Holy Spirit. We want to prevent institution from being the kind of cumbersome obstacle that stops organizations or it stops movements flourishing. But certainly, thinking institutionally, thinking about how you can set up institutions that have influence is going to be a key part of how we genuinely bring impact to our world. I was thinking about this and how to illustrate the point. A guy who's become a friend of my dad's in the last couple of years, Bob Roberts, remarkable man. He's been a pastor of a church for many, many years that's planted many other churches. Increasingly, the way he talks is that when he's traveling and doing ministry in other parts of the world, he would not simply bring a team of preachers and prophets and evangelists, as it were, but people who are skilled in particular areas, in particular perhaps business leaders, educationalists, medics, and so on, so that the influence that he has as he travels is going to be more holistic. He talked recently about how he's been serving in the most unlikely situations in Afghanistan. This is a pastor, very much a pastor from the West, in so many ways the most unlikely person to have an opportunity to work in environments like that for understandable reasons. The culture clash is so enormous, and yet he's been an incredible Christ-like, humble befriender of people who it's been very humbling for him to look to for friendship. And he's found himself being accepted into settings where where by befriending people, leaders, even leaders of Islamic organizations, people who you'd think, how would a pastor from the West really connect there? Well, the way he's done it is through kindness, through mercy, through trying to show grace, show the love of Jesus in very tangible ways. And over a long time, building relationship patiently. One of the things that started to happen is people saw the impact that he was having in other parts of the world where he was planting churches. And they said, could you help set up schools for us? Could you actually, we have major challenges, problems with how we can develop better educational systems. Could you help set up schools for us in this part of Afghanistan? And he said, I would do that, but according to principles that I would have to insist on. For example, the quota of females. I don't want it to be just boys-only schools, which is exactly what they would have been used to for generations. And he said, I'll come in, but I'm going to change the way that you would educate. I'm going to change the ethos on which you base these schools. I want there to be girls in the schools. And because of the way he's won them over, because of the heart change in terms of the relationships that he's built, it's meant that he's been given opportunities to build schools like that. Now, that's a remarkable thing. You think, how can that happen? How can a Christian, a pastor from the West, go in and have that kind of influence? It's partly because he's not only thought in terms of proclamation of the gospel. It's because he's thought holistically. How can I serve culture on a broad base? And that's just one example. There could be many others. The broad goal that we must have as we serve here in Brighton and as we want to multiply and keep seeing churches established in other parts of the world has to be what we call shalom, what the Bible calls shalom, the Hebrew word which means peace, well-being, flourishing, society operating as it was intended, things being as they should be. If ever a nation felt a desperate need for shalom, it would have been ours last August in the aftermath of the riots that were taking place across the cities. People looked around and said, what is going on? What is happening to our cities? Friends, the Bible calls us as believers to be implementers of the shalom, the peace of God. Not simply a personal experience of peace in my own individual spiritual experience, but a shared peace that the church gets to become an agent of as God's blessing is worked out into society, as justice, as mercy prevails through the work of God's people. When the city wins, the church wins. That's the way we have to see it. The way we can sometimes see it is the church wins irrespective of how the city wins. The church gets to be blessed. The church gets to grow. The church gets to look really good while the city gradually falls into disrepair. Actually, the way that God called his people to operate in Babylon in Jeremiah chapter 29 was so counterintuitive. The way he spoke to his people who were in exile in a city which would have seemed so pagan to them, so utterly unlike everything they'd grown up with, so different to their spiritual experience. Where's God? Where's the temple? How can we be the people of God in a pagan city, in a secular city, in a city that rejects the God of the Bible? How can we operate here? Surely we'll have to ghettoize ourselves, cut ourselves off, and just try and live our own Christian existence on the edge. And Jeremiah rebukes them, insists they do the opposite. It says, set up homes there in the city. Raise your children there, do business, bless the city. And he says, pray for the shalom of the city. Look for its prosperity, for in its blessing you will find your blessing. And so God's people are encouraged to do the counterintuitive thing and say, if we bless Babylon, if we bless Brighton, that's the best thing for everybody. If we can serve this city, our vision can't simply be how to build a great church. Our vision must be how to build a great city. As we do that, we find that we flourish anyway. We're flourishing as we enjoy the peace of God amongst us as his people. But we do it by serving the wider city, loving it, laying our lives down for it, even if we get rejected by it. Jesus was rejected by the city, taken outside the city, crucified outside the city, but laying his life down for the city to bring God's blessing to it. And the truth is that the Christian has a secret. The Christian is already successful. The Christian isn't having to build business and develop management and try and expand his empire so that he will be a success. He's not driven by that. He or she doesn't have to feel, if I don't succeed in my business, my life is a failure. The Christian knows, by God's grace, my failure has been taken away. By God's grace, I'm a success. By God's grace, because Jesus lived for me, died for me, rose for me, irrespective even of my failures, all my failings, my wrongdoings even, my sin, all the dreadful things in my past, those things were taken care of at the cross. I'm a new creation. I don't have to go into business trying to prove myself. I can go into my business serving, loving, because I've been loved. I've been taken care of. I've been looked after. The Christian's already successful. We can be driven by a different instinct, a different ethos than the world might be driven by. And when that happens, it can bring tremendous flourishing to the world. I haven't got time particularly to labor the last point on this side, but I do want to mention to you the importance of us being proactive about developing job opportunities. As the years go on, as the recovery perhaps takes place in the economy, the reality is that it could be actually... I've heard Ken Costa, a friend of mine from London, a business leader, talk about this being the recovery being a jobless recovery. The number of the number of people who are alienated, isolated, cut off from the recovery will be higher than might have been before this recession. And the Gallup did a huge poll, which is written about in Jim Clifton's book, The Coming Jobs War. I think it's called The Coming Jobs War. I think it is. I've got a copy of my bag. If you want to come and ask me for it afterwards. It is a really good book. It's a little bit American in terms of its focus, but it could apply to the UK. It's about the crisis in terms of employment in the Western world on the aftermath of the financial crisis. And the reality is that all across the world, what will be the watchword, what will be the hunger, the ache of people all around the world will be, what I need is a good job. What I desperately want, the thing that I can't assume anymore, is a good job. And training people, equipping people with skills, helping people to develop abilities to find work, even developing work, making work for people, is going to be a huge part even of Christian mission. The way that we serve as Christians in the Western world will be not simply through raising funds necessarily, but actually raising opportunities for people to find work, creating industry that sets people up, sets families up even. We could talk more about that. There isn't time. Let me just say very quickly, and there's a final comment, and I'm running out of time, so I'll just name these headings. What about application for us? Well, let me say, please own the vision. Dream with us. Pray with us. Be stirred with us about the vision that God's calling us to multiplication here in the city, but also beyond. How are we going to do this? Well, it's going to be done as we own the vision together and get stirred about it. Pray, serve, give. These are all staple things. None of us get to opt out from church mission, even if we're skilled in business and find that, really, I'm not gifted in terms of serving in church on a Sunday, but I'm gifted in business. That's how I serve. Praise God for you. Absolutely. You're right to think that way, but don't imagine that means that you don't serve in the life of the church. The reality is, as the church is healthy, as we keep serving in church life, we're able to achieve more anyway. And we need to live with this, in a sense, two-world life, where we're serving in church life and serving in the world sphere to make the church more effective and reach further. I could go on about that for a while. Can't right now. Develop a theological grid. We desperately need leaders who travel in both worlds, who aren't simplistic, who don't just think, well, good business means you behave yourself well and you fill in your tax forms properly. Well, it does, but it means so much more than that. We need to develop a far healthier, more holistic theological grid for how do we handle business, how do we have more expansive vision for how God's truth intersects with the business world. Keep reading, keep studying. There are people in this room who do that wonderfully. And if you want help with that, then come to us. Help us to help you, as this next point says. Help us to help you. If you think, look, I would like to be more effective in the things you're saying in terms of using business to serve the purpose of God. I haven't got the first idea what that means practically. Well, talk to us. Meet with us. Share your heart. Share your vision. Even share your frustration, if need be. Because we would like to serve you, but we need to know where you're itching so we can scratch. So communicate with us. We would like to use the city online more and more effectively for this so that we know how the business guys really feeling the ache at the moment. Where are they struggling? Where can we serve them most effectively? And that means communication. It means building relationship. It means more days like this, where we connect, where we listen, where we get time together. And finally, creative funding. Obviously, funding is a massive part of what we need to do. Giving on a general level is going to be a staple way in which we achieve what we're called to. As a church, we are an incredibly generous bunch of people who give phenomenally well. But I sometimes think that there'll need to be some creative thoughts about how we raise money in the years to come. To really achieve the objectives we feel called to. And if it comes to creative ideas about making money, I'm not the guy. I haven't gotten. All I've got is prayer and raising money publicly. I think some of you will be far more skilled at thinking creatively about how can we release funds to achieve more here and more there and more there. And many of you will bring that to the table. I've done what I thought I would do. How are we doing, Matt? Have I done quite well? Have I? I think I deserve an enormous round of applause. You need to know, if you're new here, you need to know it is a miracle that I've spoken for that short. It's even more of a miracle if you understood any of it. But I'll hand over to Matt. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe, again.